This is Sustainable East End, a monthly series about how land use, water resources, energy, transportation, and food impact the environment of the Twin Forks of Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I spoke recently with Dr. Chris Gobler of the School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at Stony Brook University and fisherman Sean Barrett of Dock to Dish, a community-supported fishery. We talked about the promise of kelp farming in local bays for use as food, fertilizer, fuel, and for cleaning up pollution. Also, we noted kelp's ability to reduce ocean acidification and provide habitat, thereby improving conditions for our region's shellfishing industry. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Dr. Gobler and Sean Barrett, to Sustainable East End. First, I'd like to turn to you, Sean. Tell us a little bit about yourself and, tell us about Dock to Dish as well.
So actually, similar to Dr. Gobler's son right now, who I see on Instagram sometimes, I got started fishing in the early 80s in the Hampton Bays. So I grew up around the Shinnecock Canal and Shinnecock Inlet. And when we were young kids, all we did was fish all day. And Hampton Bays in the 1980s and 90s was more of a commercial fishing, active commercial fishing port than it is now. And in a nutshell, I just grew up and watched the fish and seafood markets changing over a 20, 30 year span. And found myself about 10 years ago in a position with a few different backgrounds and fields that kind of had qualified me, I think, or given me the confidence to create the first community-supported fishery program in New York State in Montauk about 10 years ago called Dock to Dish. So that's probably a story for another episode, but that kind of changed the trajectory of the local seafood conversation and really brought kind of a hyper-local conversation into the seafood, restored or returned us to a way that seafood used to be back when I was growing up. And that was really the whole goal of that. But throughout that whole time, Francesca, over the last 10 years, I also was working very closely with some friends at first in Maine, and then a good friend of mine, Bren Smith at GreenWave. And we originally were talking about, Bren had started a community supported fishery across the Long Island Sound from us. He was doing at the time, going back about 7 or 8 years now, Thimble Island Ocean Farm. He had started a oyster CSF, community supported fishery, and was starting to do kelp, seaweed farming, which really opened up my eyes a lot. And I think not long after I started working with Bren on kelp farming, I tuned into one of Dr. Gobler's State of the Bays address, which I'm sure Dr. Gobler remembers. I caught it on local TV one night and proceeded to pound on his door and pursue him for a meeting with me because I was so blown away just by that presentation and by all the kind of expert information and knowledge that he was putting forth in the State of the Bays address. That's going back a number of years now. But I, at that time, had told Dr. Gobler he seemed to me to be the Obi-Wan Kenobi of local waterways. And so that really kind of amplified and pushed us forward after seeing what Dr. Gobler was describing was happening to the local waterways and gauging that against what I remembered the local waterways from growing up looked like. I started to see kelp farming potentially as a solution to nitrogen loading and to restoring aquatic habitats and nurseries and things like that. So a lot of what I was doing with Bren Smith and hearing on his side as far as the solution, I was matching that with Dr. Gobler's descriptions of the problem. And I'll fast forward to about 3 years ago, and then can let Dr. Gobler kind of chime in on this. But we teamed up with Stony Brook University and GreenWave and Dr. Dish. We formed a three-way grant project, basically, with the Farm Viability Institute to see what would happen if we started to grow kelp in New York waters. And I feel like that's really where the magic carpet ride began. So Dr. Gobler, do you remember our early days? I have a distinct memory of bringing Bren Smith across the Long Island Sound to SOMAS, to your headquarters there at the Marine Station. And Mike Dole helped us put on, myself and Brent Smith did kind of a little song and dance about ocean farming and kelp farming. We brought all a whole bunch of our friends from NOAA and DEC, and a lot of Dr. Gobler's master's students and folks were in the classroom. But I think that was kind of a seminal moment. And from there, it's really just been a wild, adventurous ride to how we got to here today. So with that, Dr. Gobler.
Yes, Dr. Gobler. Well, that is a great introduction to Dr. Gobler. So tell us about your involvement and your interest and research into kelp and kelp farming.
Yeah, well, I think Sean covered a good bit of it, but I spent the first, I've been a professor on the campus in Southampton for more than 20 years now, going back to the 20th century, actually. And the first decade or so of my career was really focused on identifying, looking at what's going on in the waters. And, it really, I guess, would amount to finding out all the things that were wrong. And so finding out that there are these harmful algal blooms that were emerging that we didn't used to have, that are now, came out of nowhere in some cases, so to speak, and are now become regular problems. Finding out that our waters are lacking in oxygen, that they're acidified, and that all of these things have contributed to the declines of some of the most major fisheries on Long Island. And, when I say fisheries and you say the word Long Island together, that really means bivalves. So hard clams and scallops, which were some of the biggest fisheries in the U.S. for those species on Long Island, have collapsed and are down 99%. And so, and we've lost our seagrass, we've lost a lot of our salt marsh. This was documented. At first it was documenting, here are the problems. And then it was identifying, a lot of this is coming from both the overloading of nitrogen and then also being exacerbated by climate change. And then I'd say, the next phase of my career during the last decade has really been focused on what can be done to address these issues and to improve conditions. There's many tools in the toolbox, but, I guess it was around that time, one of the first things we started doing was growing seaweeds. Now, in fact, not kelp, but other seaweeds that you actually find during the summer. And we've developed and have some good approaches for growing out things like sea lettuce and Gracilaria, which are green and red algae, respectively. They grow quite well. And but it was, as then picking up on Sean's narrative there, it was about, I think, 4 years ago or so that, the connection was made between myself and Sean and Brent Smith at Green Wave and Mike Dole in my lab about the prospects for growing kelp and that project that Sean called out. And the interesting thing about that project is that up until that project, the dogma about kelp was that it could only be grown in deep open waters. And so for the project, what we tried was saying if we could grow it in actually shallow estuaries, the type you find on the south shore of Long Island, for example, Shinnecock Bay, Mauritius Bay, Great South Bay. And what we've actually found is it grows better in those conditions than it does elsewhere. The part that I'm most drawn to is the positive effects that the kelp can have on the ecosystem. And maybe we'll be talking about that in more detail, but the bottom line is that any seaweed, and kelp as well, essentially puts into the water the things that we need more of, specifically oxygen, and takes out of the water the things that we need less of, specifically nitrogen and carbon dioxide. I love that effect and it's measurable and it's scalable. So, for me, that's quite exciting.
You said you wanted to talk a little bit more about how it can clean up, and let's do that, and then go on to how it creates habitat also for then species that can also be farmed.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, kelp is a photosynthetic organism like any tree or plant. And through the process of photosynthesis, it's absorbing CO2 to make new material as it grows. And then also as it's growing, because you know, plants are more than just carbon, it's taking up nitrogen right out of the water. And it's also taking up other nutrients like phosphorus that are also sometimes problematic. And actually, you know, we haven't even gotten to the point of publishing this yet, but it's becoming clear that actually the kelp can adapt to the environment you put it in. And so what we're actually finding is that it actually takes up more nitrogen when you put it in a more nitrogen rich location. And therefore, if your goal is to use it as a, you know, I'll use the term nitrogen sponge or nitrogen sink, however you want to call it, it'll actually do best. It you know, will do best in those regions where there's actually more nitrogen than you actually want. So that's an incredible benefit. On the CO2 front, you know, for those who aren't aware, you know, we're in an era of climate change here on planet Earth. And, you know, a lot of people like to say, oh, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the levels of CO2 have increased by, you know, 33%. But, you know, frankly, if you look at the true trends, what's really the most troubling is what's been going on since about 1980. And so, you know, that's within my lifetime where the CO2 levels are now at almost 420 parts per million in the atmosphere, where, you know, back in the 20th century, we were looking at, you know, maybe 350 or so, and people were worried when it went above 350. And so as the CO2 levels go up, the pH of the ocean is going down. You know, I won't give a chemistry lesson here, but you'll just have to take my word for it. And that has a knock-on effect of causing what we call ocean acidification. And that's a significant and serious threat to many types of marine life. But the types we worry about most are the organisms that make a shell out of calcium carbonate. So that includes all those bivalves that used to be so important here in Long Island, clams, mussels, oysters, scallops. And also, you know, thinking globally includes also things like coral reefs. But people are worried about how the ocean acidification is going to affect bivalves. In fact, I published a paper with some scientists from the EPA in the last year, essentially showing that if everything stays the same, you know, our shell fisheries as they stand now could be stable. But if we experience, you know, accelerating ocean acidification, the likelihood of our local shell fisheries remaining stable and not collapsing further decreases significantly. And so, you know, the upshot there being this kelp can come in and serve the purpose of actually soaking up that carbon dioxide. And it's not that we're going to reverse the trends of global climate change with growing kelp. It'll contribute to it, but it's not a global solution. But what I'm most interested in is the ability of intensely grown kelp to create what I'm calling a halo effect around, for example, an oyster farm, and to be able to bathe those oysters as they grow in water that's free of ocean acidification. And we have signs that that is exactly what it can do. It's just a matter of getting the scale right. So, and you know, I don't want to go on too long here, but just to go back to the nitrogen end of things, you know, we live locally in an era where the interest in ameliorating excessive nitrogen loading is at an all-time high. And you have every agency from the town to the county to the state doing all they can to reduce nitrogen loading into coastal waters. And in many cases, people are focused on what we call wastewater and on-site septic systems, because that's the biggest source on Eastern Long Island. But the fact of the matter is that effort is going to take years. And even once it's addressed on land, it's going to take more years for the groundwater that's been contaminated with high nitrogen to work its way out, and for that groundwater eventually be clean. And so these kelp farms, and even seaweed farms in general, hold the promise of taking immediate action and removing that nitrogen now, while we are also in parallel addressing what's going on land.
This is Sustainable East End on WPKN Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Dr. Chris Gobler of the School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at Stony Brook University, and with fisherman Sean Barrett of Dock to Dish. Well, that's really exciting, and I want to come back to that, but I'd like to turn now again to Sean Barrett of Dock to Dish. Talk about what you're doing with kelp farming and how this beneficial effect of deacidification in a kind of halo, a local area, impacts what you're doing and what your plans are.
Yeah, great question, Francesca. And I feel like, first of all, I could listen to Dr. Gobler all day. I love science, and I think he just lays down such a bedrock of good, strong science, which makes a lot of our work easier and to build on top of that, obviously. Just gives us a lot of confidence and helps us navigate much more clearly. So I think where I've come in, Francesca, if you can imagine the kind of kelp farm, the rise of kelp farming in New York State, almost in three different boxes. And the first is regulatory, getting this okayed with state and county municipalities and government and regulatory agencies. The center box would be the actual farming of kelp, which we've now begun experimentally in a research phase with about a dozen or so-ish oyster growers who are now growing kelp for the first time in research scenarios throughout Eastern Long Island. And the piece that comes after that, the third box, is what do you do with all that farm kelp? And that's really where I'm mostly focused over the years. Brent Smith from GreenWave and I, we've worked together. I just stepped down as chairman of the board at GreenWave after a long stretch where Brent and I worked together. Essentially, he handles the farming piece. We work on the regulatory piece together. But then when it comes time, when that kelp comes out of the water, what do you do with it then? And so over the years, we've worked pretty intensively with some groups in Maine, which has a very robust kelp, quote unquote, industry, and Alaska, which has a burgeoning fledgling kelp industry that we've been helping to get set up, even as far away as New Zealand. GreenWave has very long tentacles across the globe that they focus on the farming piece for the most part. But inevitably, in all these markets, we get the regulatory space cleared out. We get the kelp farming okayed. We get a pretty aggressive kelp farming underway in box number two. And then comes this enormous bottleneck when 100 or 200,000 pounds of kelp is being landed in the first or second season. And there's this kind of incredible scramble to figure out, where does it go? What do we do with it? So my historical role, Francesca, has been in that third box, is figuring out marketplaces. For a number of years now, we've been importing Connecticut kelp and running that through the Dock to Dish program to our chefs in New York City. We helped to get Google headquarters serving kelp with a whole bunch of restaurants. Locally, you would know Nick and Tony's and Almond in Bridgehampton, a lot of the kind of forward-thinking leaders in the culinary space working with kelp as food. But because of we've been paying such close attention to Dr. Gobler's work, we've also come to realize that kelp as food is going to be a very difficult conversation for the New York kelp scene, the kelp farmers, because of all the water quality issues that are going on and increasing awareness about that. So traditionally, people don't like to know that the waters are having troubles with quality issues, and that the algae that's coming out of there, you're encouraging them to eat that. There's going to be inherent resistance with that. So we're looking more to Alaska and Maine for the kelp as food conversation, and New York kelp kind of rising as the kelp as fertilizer conversation. So what we've done is rolled out a kind of awareness, eat more kelp, kind of just to get people interested in talking about the kelp conversation, with some merchandising and things like that. But the next phase we're working with, Dr. Gobler once explained to me his vision of closing the loop, basically having kelp farms in local waters, sucking the nitrogen out of the waterways, then converting that into fertilizer products that would then go back into local lawns, golf courses, certain agricultural operations, and basically prevent. And he had a really great kind of visual. He said, imagine, close your eyes and imagine just like many 18 wheelers of synthetic fertilizer freight being coming over the bridges onto Long Island year after year after year. Well, like one very effective use for the local kelp would be to turn it into a fertilizer and shut off that faucet of imported synthetic fertilizer that's essentially adding to an already pretty terrible problem that we're having with too much nitrogen. The last thing we really need to be doing is importing it from elsewhere. So that's really the larger goal or vision that we're moving towards, is how do we create a closed loop situation where nitrogen is seeping into the aquifers, into the local waterways. We're having and this nitrogen loading epidemic, creating a circular loop where then the kelp farms suck up or create what Dr. Goldberg calls a sponge or a sink effect, and then converting that into a kelp fertilizer product that we then would go back into local Long Island farms. And essentially over time, that would, first of all, eliminate the import of synthetic fertilizer and nitrogen coming from abroad or off island, and have a whole series of knock-on effects or cascading effects of benefits as far as local job creation. And Dr. Goldberg can also speak more about restoration of aquatic habitats and how these kelp farms can create nurseries for small fish and crustacea and things like that. So again and again, when we've kind of run this scenario through top thinkers and leaders in all these different spaces, they come back with the same kind of impression. And they say, you know, like, it just seems like a win, 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 win. And I ask people all the time, like, punch a hole in this. Like, explain to me, where's the Achilles heel? How does this not work? And this, I bring that question to the smartest people I know, Dr. Gobler being amongst them, and ask them, like, you know, punch a hole in this idea, this concept. What if we started to create this circular loop for nitrogen where the kelp farms start to suck the nitrogen out of the waterway and we put that right back into the soil? And I'm to date still looking for someone to come and say that won't work, and here's why. So until that happens, Francesca, that's the path we're on. And fingers crossed, hopefully we're going to start making some pretty fast headway in the coming months and years on this front.
That is so exciting. And Dr. Gobler, I would like to, you know, have you talk a little bit about habitat restoration. But in the time, so it may be a short answer on that. And then I'd like to end, Sean, with you just telling us, you know, you talked about the regulatory, you know, where is that at, and what, you know, what people can do to find out more about it and, you know, participate if they'd like to. So starting with Dr. Gobler, give us a quick tour of habitat restoration then with kelp.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that any marine organism appreciates having more habitat to swim in and be around. And so, you know, we've lost 90% of our seagrass across New York State. That used to be a habitat where you'd see juvenile fish and shellfish move into, and with the main reason being that the particularly for the fish, it allows them to hide from predators. And so if we have more kelp, it's almost certain that it's going to serve a similar, what we call ecosystem service, and that you'll see, and we've already have seen, different sorts of small fish, particularly this time of year. They're just starting to move into the estuaries, be a great place for them to go as a habitat, and probably some invertebrates as well. So I'll leave it at that since we're running short on time.
That's great. Dr. Gobler, before you go, I wanted to ask you a question because it actually came up. I was talking with my granddaughter last night. She's out here for a visit, and she saw the sea stars, you know, the sea stars that have been dried out, that have been decoration for about 30 years in this house. And she said, you know, where did they go? And I said, you know, I used to find sea stars on the beach back in the 80s. And then they went away. Did they go away? Why did they go away? And could they come back?
Can they come back? Yes. Why they went away? I don't have the exact answer for that. But, you know, we do know we live in an era of very rapid change. And I do know that from what I know, the sea stars appreciate colder ocean water and, you know, the temperature changes we've been seeing during, particularly during summer are important and notable because, you know, the thing about summer temperatures is that, you know, every time you set it, you push the envelope, you're getting higher than we've ever had before. And so, so that's probably part of the situation there.
Hey, Francesca and Dr. Goldberg, we've worked with this in Dr. Dish as well. And you hit the nail on the head earlier, Dr. Goldberg, was that those sea stars actually are predatory fish that eat hard shell clams and things like that. So when those fisheries collapsed, when hard shell clams, that you heard the statistics Dr. Goldberg gave us earlier from the, you know, at one time our waters were leading the nation with hard shell clams, oysters, wild oysters and things like that. So I think if we really dug deep into this space, we would find that those sea stars have nothing to eat is one of the other reasons why you don't see them around much anymore.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. So now I know. And so Sean, tell us where we are, you know, how soon can we get this underway and what do we need to do to have that happen?
Yeah, great question, Francesca. And I think we are doing a ton of work behind the scenes on the regulatory front. I serve on the Marine Resources Advisory Council of the DEC. And in 2018, we got the kelp bill passed through that council in a bipartisan 10-0 in favor vote, which is rare, but just shows you the kind of unified support for the kelp bill. And if people go to eatmorekelp.com, they'll see at the top of that page a sign-on petition to Senator Kaminsky, who we're meeting with next week. We have about 6,000 signatures on there right now. We're trying to get to 7,000 before our meeting with him. And that eatmorekelp.com, the petition at the top of that page, will also give listeners a very good description of where we are on the regulatory front. And we're moving right along, but we need as many signatures on that petition as we could possibly get to hopefully get the kelp bill passed through, which will legalize kelp farming in New York State.
Wow, that's great. And I want to thank both of you so much for talking with us here on Sustainable East End. This is some of the most exciting stuff to learn about in a time when so often the news is doom and gloom. This really lays out some real hope. So thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me, Francesca.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This is Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We heard Dr. Chris Gobler of the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University and fisherman Sean Barrett of Dr. Dish, a community-supported fishery. More information about Dr. Gobler's work is available at www.somas.stonybrook.edu. Information about Dr. Dish is at drdish.com. Additional references about kelp farming are on our website, sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday of each month at this time, and also on the second Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. Programs are archived at www.sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.